Right. So this is the, I think, the second talk at this seminar from the Spintronics program. And in the first, Alan McDonald talked a bit about spin Hall currents, and I wanted to harken back to that for a second to comment that these are an example of generating and driving spin polarized currents without magnetic fields and without magnetic materials. And although it's been known for a while that you could transport spin for some distance coherently in semiconductors, it's really only recently been clear that you can do quite a bit without magnetic fields. Or magnetic materials. So this, you could say, is spintronics without those things. And these include what you might call spin injection, or the generation of spin polarized distributions, accumulation without magnetic fields or magnetic materials. The spin Hall effect in certain contexts is like this. It's also coherent spin manipulation in transport. And I'd even put here direct optical excitation of spin currents. So this decoupling from magnetic fields and magnetic materials, I'm going to argue, is advantageous, particularly from magnetic fields. For magnetic materials, it means that we can think about spin in semiconductor materials that are extremely well understood, certainly compared to magnetic semiconductor materials. And so what I'd like to talk about today is some ideas for manipulating single spins / doing qubit operations without these magnetic fields or materials. Okay, so to set this up, let's meet our qubits. Certainly, I think everybody here is comfortable with qubits being some two-state system, some particle in some linear combination of the two states. And in the case of our spins, these will be up and down, at least initially. We'll talk about other situations soon. And so our state is going to be some linear superposition of the two. Now, if we want to do an operation in kind of the traditional way, we might imagine applying a magnetic field, changing the energy of one relative to the other, and then you're going to have the ability to change the phase here between the two. And if you pick a different axis rather than the up or down we have here, then you can fully access the possible combinations, the two-level system. Now, rather than applying a magnetic field and doing that, the way this is often done in practice is through magnetic resonance, where you apply a strong magnetic field to split these two states by a large energy, and then you apply an AC magnetic field as the spin is processing around in that. And you do it in phase with a frequency so that if it's over here, it, for example, would process this way. And then when it comes around to here, it's changed its phase and it's processing that way. So that's a convenient way to access individual qubits. So you also have the strong B field and generally a weak, strong static B field and a weak transverse AC magnetic field. Okay, our two qubit operations. Well, we need to find some way to act on a two qubit space. So, for example, we might have this linear combination of two spins, which is a triplet, this one, which is a singlet, and then by changing the energies of one relative to the other, you can manipulate the two qubits themselves. And this is usually done via Heisenberg interaction, at least theoretically, which is going to split the energies of these two here. And you can see that if you change the energies of these two relative to one another, that if you start out, say, with this state here, you can then break it down into the linear superposition of these two, and you have some energy difference. If you evolve to the point where this is a minus one, you're then going to get this state, which is the swapped version of this. And it's well known that the square root of swap plus these single qubit operations here are enough to do any of the quantum computational algorithms you might wish to implement.
Okay.
So, in this context, it is that you apply this twice and you get swap. So, yes, T is half the time. So, instead of getting e to the I pi here, you'll get e to the I pi over 2. And I don't wish to go into the details of why this spans the space of what you want to do, but let's just take it as a given that these are the operations that we need to do, and from an implementation point of view, we're looking for real systems that will enable us to do that. Now, a lot of the work in the solid state on trying to implement these things was motivated by this work by Loss and DiVincenzo, where they proposed a specific realization of a system that in principle could allow you to do this. Now, just about every aspect of the original proposal, every physical aspect of the original proposal, has been replaced by some better way to do the operation. So it's not really, I don't want to get into the details of exactly what they proposed here, for example, in terms of spin measurements, which were related to nucleation of ferromagnetic domains, which is perhaps not tremendously practical. But what they did do is outline that it should be possible to imagine ways of doing this manipulation. And one of the things that's persisted is the way, from the original suggestion, is the way of doing this here, which is through controllably manipulating an interaction between the two spins. So the picture here was that you would have two dots, each had a state where an electron could be spin up or down. And then the wave functions in these dots would overlap with each other, which would lead to this kind of effective interaction, And by controlling the overlap with a gate here, you could control this J. And the mechanism was driven essentially by a very traditional mechanism of magnetism in the solid state, which is just this idea that if you have two states that are next to each other, or think of them as qubits if you wish, but two states that are next to each other, and the spins in them are anti-aligned, then it is possible for this spin to hop over here, doubly occupy this briefly and virtually. There's an energy cost U to do that, and then it comes back. So this is a virtual process which gives you a J, which goes like T squared over U. And that's the mechanism for antiferromagnetism, and it's the controllable mechanism that was proposed to be able to perform this operation here. Okay. Yeah.
It's T squared all the time, or it levels off something?
Oh, sure. If T becomes comparable to U, then this is going to break down. So this is a perturbative expression, but for most physical situations, your T here, you're thinking, is on the order of a tenth of a volt. Your U is on the order of a couple of volts. And so you get that for localized states. Now, in quantum dots, all the energy scales become smaller, but still, you're usually in this regime. Okay. Now, what I'd like to do is just take a look at why you might want to do these things without the magnetic fields that are involved here. And in order to do that, what I'd like to do is compare how much essentially delta E you can apply in this configuration. So compare the coherent manipulation energy, or in the case of a magnetic field, just the magnetic field, with the noise that you have around. Because you imagine that anything that you're going to use, if you have some process where you change these energies through applying an external magnetic field, you have to worry about magnetic noise in the system that's going to be ever present. Certainly, the low temperature experimentalists can say quite a lot about how much magnetic noise they get from elevators and other nasty things. So let's estimate this for a magnetic field. Let's just take one Bohr magneton and let's have it flip up and down some distance away from where you want to do something interesting. So the magnetic field you get is going to look something like this, where this mu naught is 10 to the minus 6 Tesla meters per amp, mu b 10 to the minus 23 amps meter squared. And for R, if you're going to get these spins close enough to be able to make them overlap or not overlap, they're probably going to be within about 10 nanometers. You can say 100 nanometers. Let's take 10 nanometers at this time. And what you get out of this is about a tenth of a Gauss. Now, you compare that with the ability that you have to apply an AC magnetic field, which, if we want to be generous, we would say is on the order of 0.1 Tesla. This is the AC field, so you have a strong, maybe 10 Tesla field, and then you have a transverse one. So this is about 10 to the 3 Gauss. And so you're looking at a ratio of about, say, the noise to be coherent of about 10 to the minus 4. Ouch. I mean, this is, of course, you have the ability to do quantum error correction, and the threshold that people usually use is an error, say, of 10 to the minus 6, and so you would square this, get 10 to the minus 8, and you'd say, well, I'm under the error threshold, so that's okay. But really, if you want to do this, you're going to want to have more than just operating at this edge, because you know the time that you need to spend error correcting is going to be more and more of a problem the closer you get to this threshold here. Okay. So it's worthwhile asking, if I take the same kind of quantity here and try to compare the coherent manipulation energy or field with the noise, what am I going to get if I consider an electric field? Let's leave aside for the moment whether it's even possible to use electric fields to do this. I would argue, and I'll show you later on, that you can. But let's just evaluate this kind of thing. Now, in semiconductors, the typical source of noise in the electric field is going to be some charge hopping between two sites. And so the noise electric field that you would get would be charge distance that it's hopping, dielectric constant, and the distance from where you're trying to do something where this charge is hopping back and forth. Now this distance here, typical number might be a nanometer. This R here, I'm going to choose something that's quite a bit bigger, 10 times bigger than this, and the reason is that as the spins that you're working with are flipping up and down, you're not getting electric fields out of them. So this is something that's noisy within the material, and it's quite reasonable to have those places about 100 nanometers away. So if you put these numbers in, and here I'm going to take a relative dielectric constant of 10, since we're thinking about a semiconductor, then you get this is about 100 volts per meter. Now, by comparison, the breakdown fields in semiconductors are on the order of 5 times 10 to the 7 volts per meter. And so the ratio here is quite a bit bigger, 2 times 10 to the minus 6. So just from this simple estimate, you can argue that if you can do things with electric fields, you'd be happier than if you're doing things with magnetic fields. What if we can manipulate things with optical fields, photon fields? What kind of coherent manipulation energy is relative to noises are we going to get? Well, if we take, and this of course is remarkably optimistic, but let's take 300 Kelvin and let's ask how much energy is in the black body radiation. Okay, so this is the, at 300 Kelvin you've got about 10 microjoules per meter cubed just from black body. And let's try to convert that into, well, let's compare it with what we can do. Let's first figure out what electric field we might be talking about. We can estimate that using this approach, and we're going to get an electric field that's on the order of 500 volts per meter. So in fact, black body at room temperature is maybe more important even than this, but still, you're doing better than the magnetic field approach. At room temperature, your peak intensity is for H nu of about 0.1 eV. Now, if you're doing your manipulation with an optical approach, say in gallium arsenide, where the band gap is 1.5 eV, what you really should do is ask, how much intensity is a 1.5 eV relative to 0.1 eV? And the black body form is well known, certainly. So this is easy to calculate. And you're basically working with an absolutely huge number in here if you're working with 1.5 volts. And so the amount of intensity at 300 Kelvin that's sitting out at 1.5 eV is about 10 to the minus 22. The intensity at the peak. So this is the intensity at 1.5 volts eV. Okay, so if I just want to do some rough estimate, you'll see that it's pretty reliable to do something pretty rough. I'll just take this number here and I'll say, well, I should have something like 10 to the minus 27 joules per meter cubed sitting at 1.5 volts. It's not going to be that, but it'll be close. Now let's compare with what you can do with lasers. So compare it to the coherent field. And the typical number I like to think of for a tabletop laser is 10 to the 9 watts per square centimeter. This is for a 100 femtosecond pulse. And if you work that into the number of joules per meter cubed, you get something like 3 times 10 to the minus 3 joules per meter cubed. Okay, whereas my really rough estimate over here is giving me 10 to the minus 27. And so the ratio of noise to coherent manipulation would be something like 10 to the minus 24. Okay, so it's when you look at these things, I think it starts to become clear why, if there's a way to do things optically, you might really want to do them optically, because you have access to a tremendous amount of noiseless manipulation.
What is the order of magnitude of correction?
Yeah, it depends on the situation. If it's for this? Well, if it's quantum dots, then if you make these lateral quantum dots, then U is usually nowhere close to that. If instead you had self-assembled dots that are configured properly, or if you had fabricated dots, which are considerably smaller, then it's quite reasonable to get U's that are 10 times room temperature. And if it's quantum dot molecules, sure. Okay, so I'm going to move on and talk about how we might do this or this. And so before I do that, if anybody wants to challenge these numbers, you're welcome to. Okay. So I'm going to start in a kind of a hybrid I'm going to describe a couple of approaches that people have been talking about and trying to understand what the limits are of the approaches. And I'm going to start with those that are kind of hybrid ones, where you're using a static magnetic field and you're doing your coherent manipulation with, say, an AC electric field. So you get some of the advantages of doing things with the electric field because you can make the static magnetic field quite large. And so, there are other additional advantages besides this issue of noise versus coherent manipulation energy when you start thinking about doing things with electric fields, and these include making small contacts, so scalability, and it's also related to integration and reduction of crosstalk. If you're manipulating one qubit, you don't want to be manipulating another qubit by mistake. Okay, so in this hybrid approach, there's something that's been referred to as G-tensor modulation resonance. And this is described theoretically and demonstrated experimentally, not for single spins, but for an ensemble of spins in this paper. And here the trick is that in semiconductor materials, the G-tensor that you would have can be a function of the electric field. So by applying an electric field, you can change the components of that G-tensor, and you may change them differently depending on which component it might be. You can imagine this as this G-tensor involves spin and orbit. The orbit is coupled to the spin. And by sort of squeezing the wave function more in one direction versus another, you can quench the G-factor for one direction relative to the other, drive it closer to 2.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Is there a specific condition in the spin orbit interaction to make it possible to get reduce the whole thing down to the quench moment?
For linear response to a magnetic field? Well, I think for a linear response, that is... that's generic. There are it's got to be symmetric, so I think you can show that you not only can you reduce it down to this, but you can also, just like with a moment of inertia, you can find principal axes. So if you allow me to, since it's a symmetric tensor, if you allow me to pick my axes, and I can always write it. In this form, with some defined axes. And so the trick in using this is to apply your static magnetic field in a direction that's not along a principal axis. Okay, because then, like in this situation here, GXX and GZZ are different. It means that this, which, I can think about this as a precession vector, that precession vector is not parallel to the magnetic field. So I can have a magnetic field, and I have a precession vector because GXX and GZZ are different. And now, as I change these I change one proportionately different than the other, this angle is going to change. And so I can represent that as the sum of a static precession vector plus an oscillating transverse one, which is just, and then just use the exact same formalism I would for ESR, for electron spin resonance, where I'm assuming that that transverse precession frequency is coming from a magnetic field. But now I don't have an AC magnetic field, I have an AC electric field, which is producing sort of a pseudo magnetic field. It's oscillating. Okay, so this is one direction, and I wanted to point to it because it allows me to give an example where I'm still talking about spin 1/2. Because now I'm going to...
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
The electric field, will it be localized near the surface of the semiconductor?
Well, usually... Yes, that's how you're going to construct it. So usually you will have some kind of epilayer that you've made, that you've grown, that's some thickness,
like a double layer,
tenth of a micron or a micron thick, and you have a back gate, so you have some ground plane, and then you have little gates on that you use to apply the electric fields locally. And you know, this is one of the things that took a lot of effort by groups such as the Harvard group and the Delft group to really get those gates close to the dots, so that the range of them is quite small. Okay. Now, the next signpost on this pathway is to say maybe we can come up with some other combination of spins that's going to allow us to do the manipulation but it's more accessible to an electric field. And there's a description of how this can be done and how this can simplify the approach. Given in this paper here, where you say, let's make our qubits out of these states. We already know how to change the energies of one of those, of these two, how to create an energy splitting between these with this controllable hopping matrix element. So let's just say that this here is my zero, and this here is my one. And now when I do that control, instead of thinking about it as coupling two qubits, it's actually allowing me to do a single qubit operation on this logical qubit. And so in order for this to work, you use the controlled hopping. And the other thing that was proposed in this paper was that if the G factors of these two spins are different, then you can also get access to the other direction, because this allows one phase modulation, but it doesn't give you all the axes. In order to get that, you need a different G factor. So different G factors for two, say, physical spins in the logical qubit. Now, this was recently realized effectively by Hedda et al. And for them, what they did is they did the control of T, but then instead of this, essentially the way they were able to get access to the other axis was using the hyperfine fields of the nuclei in two different dots. Okay, so for this, also you have no AC magnetic field, although in order to manipulate these the way you want, it's useful to have a static magnetic field, and certainly here a static magnetic field was used. Okay. This points us to another direction, sort of another signpost on the way away from magnetic fields, which is that this is an example of a logical qubit that's based on integer spin rather than half-integer spin. Now, the reason that you want to do integer spin is more than just this here. This sort of gives you an example of why integer spin is a good thing. But there are other important reasons. And I'd summarize them as saying that if you have integer spin, then you have no worries from the Cramer's theory. You have double degeneracy without the breaking of time reversal symmetry in the case of half integer. But in the case of integer, you don't need to break time reversal symmetry in order to split all these states. And I'll just give you one example of a nice system that shows this, which is manganese in gallium arsenide. Another example, I'll talk about this one, but another example is actually the NV center in diamond. But if we look at this one here, manganese, when you put it into gallium arsenide, has a core 5/2 spin. Okay, has a half-filled D shell. And then, because its valence isn't the same as the gallium that it goes in for, it binds a hole to it in the system. It binds a heavy hole, and through the spin-orbit interaction, this heavy hole has an L of 1 and an S of 1/2, which go anti-parallel to the core spin, and so the ground state is J equals 1, which is 4, you know, in a sense, 4 electrons. It's the 5 here, minus the one from here, plus one unit of orbit. Now, J equals 1, it turns out, is very special in gallium arsenide, because gallium arsenide has very high symmetry from a lattice point of view. Symmetry is TD. So for an object that has integer spin, there is an irreducible representation unsplit by the crystal field, that's J equals 1. Okay, and this has been seen that the manganese is not split in gallium arsenide in the ESR measurements. Okay, so that's one. It's high symmetry. But the second thing that's really good is that it does not have inversion symmetry. And the reason this is good is that if you apply an electric field to a system and it has inversion symmetry, you expect the splittings to go like E squared. But for a system without inversion symmetry, any energy splittings are going to be proportional to the electric field. And so you get a Hamiltonian for this ground state J equals 1. Okay, which is linear in electric field, doesn't break time reversal symmetry. And putting in some numbers, for an electric field of 40 kilovolts per centimeter, which is a factor of 10 below the breakdown field, this splitting is on the order of what you would get for a 1 Tesla field. So by alternating an AC electric field, you can generate an effective perturbation on the order of a Tesla, because you have this nice high symmetry system but without inversion symmetry. And this is work principally by Jianming Tang, who's here. Now, for this Hamiltonian, you can see that by applying electric field in just about every direction, I will split all three states. So I can manipulate all three states independently. There's the special directions are the 1-1-1 direction, where I only split it into a 2 and a 1. But everywhere else, it's threefold. Okay, I have about 15 minutes left. Is that about right? Okay. So these were examples I wanted to give you of on the path towards electric fields. Here, in this approach, you don't need any magnetic field at all. You can use a static electric field and then an alternating AC field that's transverse to it to do all of your manipulation. And then you're only...
How do you want to be able to vary?
How fast?
Yes.
Well, if you want to work under the resonant conditions, then however fast you can vary it, you use that to set the static electric field that you're going to apply. But realistically, it's possible to manipulate these things at gigahertz frequencies. You can manipulate the electric fields at gigahertz frequencies. And that's been demonstrated experimentally. In fact, that was done here. Really? No, there's the J. The J is the combined object. So, so that's the J equals one thing here. Okay, so I've managed to do away with the magnetic field, leaving behind the electric field. What I'd like to do now is show you a couple of examples of how we can do some manipulation with optics. And that'll be the final thing. All right. Now, if I have an electron in a state, and let's say that this is a conduction state of a quantum dot, then somewhere way down here, I have all my filled valence states. They're in gallium arsenide, they're going to be roughly 1.5 volts below. If it's a quantum dot, they'll be a little closer because the quantum dot has some confining potential. And now I'd like to use some approach to manipulate the energy of this state. And the motivation here is the work done by Cohen Tanuj. Many years ago. Where the physics of what they were exploring was the shift in the energy levels of states in atoms, in this case, under the illumination of light. And so we'd like to do something similar, but we'd like to do it in a spin-selective way in a solid. And for more details, you can see these references. Where these talk about how to do single qubit operations. Okay, so let me draw some of the energy diagrams for this. Okay, the usual thing that people will draw for selection rules in semiconductor quantum dots looks something like this, where I have conduction states and valence states in a spherical dot. These four states here are eigenstates j equals 3/2. This is a j of 1/2. Okay, and so you can have transitions that satisfy selection rules that you get for plus and minus polarized light. Now, for the purposes of what I'm going to talk about here, I want to consider asymmetric quantum dots. And so the energies of these two are going to be different from these two, and they will be lower down and largely irrelevant, because that makes the selection rules cleaner. Okay. So now, if I come in with an intense circularly polarized light pulse, I'm going to modify the energies of these states. And I'll do that differently than these states over here. They should be largely ineffective. I think you can see that from that you expect to have a intensity-dependent effective magnetic field, since the spin of this is different from the spin of that. So if I have an electron that's in some linear superposition of these, it'll feel the effect as if you have a magnetic field in the direction of the propagation of the circularly polarized light. Okay. Given the time, I'm just going to put up some estimates of the size of this effect. There's more details of the theory here. The coupling strength for typical tabletop field strengths, like the ones I quoted before of a gigawatt per square centimeter, is on the order of 15 millivolts for, say, a transition energy here, which is detuned from resonant by about 70 millivolts. You don't want to illuminate exactly at this transition, or you'll create real carriers. What you want to do is illuminate a slightly different one, and so then you get a renormalization of the energy here as you change it up or down. And that's the similar kind of thing that was done by Cohen Tanuge and collaborators. 15 millivolts for splitting, if you think about how that looks from a magnetic field perspective for a G of 2, it's on the order of 100 Tesla. So you're effectively able to apply a field of 100 Tesla optically over a period of the optical pulse width, which is 100 femtoseconds long. So you have ultra-fast access to huge, absolutely huge magnetic fields in these systems. And so single qubit operations are possible with single pulses of light. You know, pi rotations are possible with single pulses of light. So you may say that's great, but we also need to be able to couple the qubits together. And there are optical suggestions for how to do that as well. Some of them involve coupling through cavities. But from a condensed matter point of view, perhaps a particularly attractive one is instead of modifying the Hopping matrix element, let's use an indirect coupling mechanism. Proposed by Lu Sham and collaborators. And it's called an optical RKKY interaction. Now, the ordinary RKKY interaction that you would have, say, in a metal, is that you have your spin sitting there, and it's going to polarize surrounding conduction electrons. Let's say this is a core spin. You have surrounding conduction electrons that are going to be polarized. And if it's an anti-ferromagnetic interaction, it would look something like this, where this is the density of the conduction electrons around it. And then if you had another core spin, say here, they would feel an effective indirect spin-spin interaction, which would go like the core conduction coupling squared times its degenerate, the density of states at the Fermi energy, and if it's non-degenerate, times n. So the optical approach is, let's modify the density of conduction electrons in our situation, not with making real electrons through optical excitation, but virtually. So if I have two spins that are bound to quantum dots, and this is my valence and conduction edge, if I illuminate the system with an optical field that's close to but not exactly equal to this transition energy here, I create virtual carriers here which can couple these two. And the effect has been estimated to be on the order of 2 millivolts for a detuning on the order of a millivolt, and for two spins separated by 10 nanometers. Okay, so summary, what I've tried to do is give you an example of some of the exotic methods of coupling spins together and of manipulating individual spins using electric fields and optics rather than magnetic fields, which are relying on our growing understanding of spin properties in semiconductors without magnetic fields or magnetic materials. That's where I'll stop. Yeah?
So, I mean, you've given us some examples of the advantage of this kind of approach.
Right.
Manipulating, doing quantum computing operations in a very modern manner.
Mm-hmm.
What about the other problem, decoherence of deep dissipation?
Okay.
Which is the reason most quantum computers fail because you can't
deep
dissipate so much.
Right. So let's look at some of the time scales. So for example, in these systems here of quantum dots, at room temperature, in an ensemble, the dephasing time has been measured to be on the order of 3 nanoseconds. And the operation time here is 100 femtoseconds. The expectation is that the spin coherence times of these systems are going to be on the order of microseconds when you get individual dots accessed. At low temperature, the already measured longitudinal spin coherence times are of the order of a millisecond. So you have 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 8th kind of differences between gate times and decoherence times already.
But that's far small.
Well, the 3 nanosecond time, again, was an ensemble time, and it probably came from the difference in G factors for the different dots that were measured. So, there's no intrinsic reason that's been identified why there's an issue with scaling that. One of the advantages about doing the operations locally is that you can sort of work in this local picture of worrying about decoherence with your neighbors.
What's the repetition rate for those 100 femtosecond pulses? Aren't those typically made by compression of much longer pulses? So the repetition rate is something like kilohertz?
Repetition rate is 100 megahertz, and so there is a duty cycle involved here, but it sort of depends on motivation. You can also split these things and have multiple pulses arriving at a period of time. I don't know actually what the limit that's, well, I wouldn't say limit, but I don't know what the current state of the art is in terms of the number of pulses that have been directed at the material a certain amount of time. But eventually you start running into issues of heating unless your material is extremely clean, because your band tail starts to absorb. But in principle, there's no reason why you can't have a lot of lasers that are synced relative to one another. At this point, I think about 3 laser cavities have been synced relative to each other. And then you can get a multiple series of pulses. Yeah?
In principle, you can create much larger electric fields if you put the whole thing in contact with, for liquid solid electrolyte. But it would be then 10 to 8 volt per centimeter easily. I don't know whether it's variable or not, but there is a problem, of course, that you cannot vary that field very fast, because relaxation of the bilayer,
right,
such designs, will be about a number of magnitudes slower than a gigahertz that you want.
Right. Right. So that's an issue. And the other thing is that these materials, these semiconductor materials, simply will not withstand the kind of large electric fields that you're talking about. They will
essentially, you're not talking
will have
larger fields. You don't need them.
Or you do. Beyond about 400, 500 kilovolts per centimeter, you get avalanche breakdown. So the field is so large that you start generating electron hole pairs, and you get a short. So that's the material limit at the moment for something like this. Now, that doesn't mean that you couldn't imagine doing some of this in an insulator, where you can sustain much larger fields, or in a ferroelectric, which has other interesting symmetry breaking properties. But for these semiconductors, that's going to be, I'm not sure that you can beat that limit.
Okay.
All right.